Welcome to Reconsider. I'm Bill Hartman. This is the podcast to challenge you to ask better questions, to look beyond traditional models of thinking and arrive at better health and fitness solutions.
All right, here we go.
Oh, so did we start?
Yeah, we're starting. On the UHP network, which is the place where people go to learn Bill's model, the Unified Health and Performance Continuum model, if anyone, for those following along at home, there seems to be a misunderstanding or a misrepresentation somewhere out there. Bill and I aren't really sure where, because we don't pay enough attention to social media to know.
Yeah.
But there's some type of miscommunication or misunderstanding where people seem to think that this model is only based on infrasternal angle or the ISA. So people come to us saying they want to learn more about the ISA model. They want to understand ISA, like it's this acronym for this thing that exists.
Yeah.
So I think we should spend this time talking about what the infrasternal angle is, why it's an important thing to measure, what that measurement and the interpretation of that measurement actually means, and then how you would apply that to treatment or training. So that's what we're going to talk about today.
Okay.
Hopefully we didn't lose anybody in the first minute and 20 seconds, because that's
obviously will be a group of people that will want to listen to this, because
I would hope
there seems to be, like I said, seems to be a point of confusion.
Yeah. And I don't want to ostracize, I don't want anyone to feel bad. This isn't, I'm not making fun of anybody. We just got this influx of applications from people saying they want to learn more about ISA, and they're training people with ISA, and we want, if we were to meet them in person, we would say, like, what do you mean by that? What does that mean to you? So instead of having that conversation, because we can't necessarily, we're going to have our own conversation about what it is and what it means and what you do with it.
Yeah.
So I will let you take the lead
here. Oh, thanks.
This is your thing, man. Like, you,
I understand.
Let's talk about the background of it a little bit, because I think the first time I was exposed to the concept of an infrasternal angle and measuring it might have been Shirley Sarman, maybe earlier. But it's not something that
I can go back at minimum, I can go back to 1922.
Yeah. I mean, I'm thinking osteopaths and maybe like A.T. Still and those guys were looking at it. But
probably. So what we're talking about is structure. We're just talking about structure. We're talking about, structure is a constraint. Humans are complex adaptive systems. One of the elements within a complex adaptive system is the influence of constraints, and structure determines what options we have. And so that's literally what we're talking about. We're talking about a way to help us identify what type of a structure that we're looking at, and then what would be the tendencies that are associated with it. And so that literally is the foundational element of the UHPC model, is that, well, we have structural constraints. It provides us with options, but it also provides us with limitations. And so that's all we're doing, is we're identifying the tendencies.
Right? Yeah.
By using structure as a guide. But we have to understand, it's like, okay, well, how are we structured? And then that falls back towards, well, if you look at the smallest of scales to the largest of scales within our structure, we're helically oriented. And then we have to say, well, if we're helically oriented, then we know that the helix is the determining factor regarding how much we can move, how we apply force into the ground, and such. And then we say, well, there's got to be a relationship somewhere that we can utilize to guide us. And that's all we're talking about.
I think one of the issues with that, people hear structure, people think architecture, they think static representations, 3D models that are just pictures in time. They try to measure this angle as a fixed point in time. And then they say, wide gets this as a intervention, narrow gets this as an intervention or a training method, and then that's it. And we just leave it at that. But there's a lot more I don't want to say subtlety to it, but it's behavioral. Right. Bill Smith made this point on the network in many videos and posts that the infrasternal angle, you are measuring behavior, movement behavior. You're not just giving someone, you're not just slapping a narrow or a wide label on somebody and sending them along to the training hall.
Yeah. It's like, well, and we've talked about this a great deal, that, you know, people get concerned because it's referenced as an angle, then people make an association that, oh, there must be an optimal that we're trying to guide someone toward. And it's always important to reiterate the fact that that is not the case. What we're identifying is the tendencies that would be associated with specific structures.
Right.
There can be extreme compensatory representations that do need to be addressed and would be favorable to make some measurable change. But it's not going to be in reference to like a certain number of degrees. What it is, yeah, is going to be reestablishing the movement of it in regarding its ability to turn into external rotation or internal rotation.
Right. So we're referring to the movement behaviors of a dynamic infrasternal angle, one that can go through its expansion and compression bandwidth without any sort of compensation. And typically any of the compensations that we would see from a bunch of external compression would cause that angle to look wider than it typically is. We don't see, there aren't any compensations to make a wide look narrow, correct?
It would be a rare occasion because of the way that compression influences the cylindrical shape of an axial skeleton.
But what would the rare occasion be, just from my own understanding?
What you would most likely see would be take somebody that's at the end of their base of support. You've got a torsion that would occur within the axial skeleton, and then the ISA would appear to be asymmetrical. It's actually twisted. Mm.
So you'll see you'll see an asymmetry, but it's actually a bend like this.
Well, it's actually take it this way and then take it this way and then pull it down. And then there's a bend in it that would appear to approximate it. But we have to appreciate the fact that we've got a big turn and actually it's a torsion within the bony structure.
I think an example that I've seen this in would be like a thrower who's wide, who has to bend their axial skeleton in order to create the right downforce.
Oh yeah. No question.
Yeah. A wide trying to perform more like a narrow, I guess.
Well, they're not trying to perform like a narrow per se. What they're trying to do is they're trying to achieve a position in space. So if you are a right-handed wide ISA thrower and you had to create a substitution for internal rotation, and the way you would do that, let's use a right-handed pitcher to be really specific here, as a right-handed pitcher steps towards home plate with the left foot and lacks the internal rotation to apply force into the ground, they will find a way to apply force into the ground. And so then what they will do is they will create an IR compensatory strategy, which is a vertical compression on the left side. So it pulls the left side into the ground, bends it, and twists the axial skeleton harder to the right. And then under those circumstances, you will get, a series of compensatory strategies that could actually alter the shape of bony structure. But in this case, it's going to bend the ISA. But the way we would typically do this, if we were going to create like a table test representation, it's like you lay somebody in the table and then you can identify the behavior. And when this circumstance, if it's bent and twisted, it could appear to be like what people say, well, they look narrow on one side and wide on the other.
Yeah.
And that doesn't.
So that would, and that is, that's, that could happen in both. That could happen for both archetypes.
True. But again, for, we're, you know, referencing like it could,
a wide looking ISA narrow.
Look like a narrow. And it's like, that's when it's going to a big turn.
You wouldn't see a compensation from a wide creating a narrow angle on both sides though. It would would not happen, but you can, so I'll clarify this for most people listening here. you can see a narrow that looks like a wide because of AP compression and actual bending. I'm making
it bends away from midline.
My hands where your ribs bend away from midline. And then you lay your tall, lanky volleyball outside hitter on the table. And then you go, oh, this guy's wide. It's like, no.
Yeah.
It doesn't, like your match
up. Your favorite frame of reference though is the tennis player that gets branded as a, you know, 6'4".
Well, yeah, I've seen it. Yeah, that's they get sent to me, and they have an anterior shoulder issue on the right arm, and they're talking about how this guy's wide and he's 6'4", and he plays D1 tennis and has been playing since he was 8. So it's like, no, I doubt it.
Yeah.
It wouldn't make a lot of sense. So we've talked a little bit about some of the things that can be confusing when it comes to measuring ISA.
Yes.
Understanding that, like, there isn't – so and this could be your fault a little bit, Bill, but the videos – because it all is sort of. Videos early on when you're starting to develop this model, you know, talking about, like, what the ideal angles based on, like, Buckminster Fuller's work and engineering work. And what was 102.6?
Okay. So, hang on. Let's create a frame of reference here so we can be very clear on what's going on. This is in reference to the open cylinder volume is what it is.
Yeah.
Actually, it's an open cylinder volume. And to maximize the volume of an open cylinder, there is a specific helical angle where the volume would be optimized. Well, maximized is what I should say.
Sure.
If you read the original paper, there's a couple ways that you can look at the measurement. And so what they did is they took a vertical measurement and then took the helical angle off of that. So if you think of like a vertical, the helical angle would be away from that vertical. And and they only measure half of it. It looks like this. You have two helices that intersect, and so they draw a line down the intersection and then they measure it off of that. And so that turns out to be 54.44 degrees, which so if you double that, then it becomes 108.8 basically. And so at one point as I'm working through this, it's like, well, this starts to make a little bit of sense because there's actually another angle that turns out to be 108 degrees when you're looking at platonic shapes and things. And it seems like, well, this must be the optimum. It is actually representative of the maximum volume of the open cylinder, but that doesn't mean that that's what you should chase. So this is not like, pigeonholing people into what are referred to as normative values for range of motion. They're actually averages. Mm-hmm. But if you had to make a volumetric comparison, you could use it, but it's not helpful because people have their own idiosyncratic structure.
Right.
And what we're actually doing, especially when we're working towards recapturing relative motions, is we have to take their idiosyncratic structure into consideration. What we're trying to do is we're trying to influence their ability to move their infrasternal angle through its excursion. So you don't make a wide and narrow, you don't make a narrow wide, and then everybody has their own representation of what their movement capabilities would be. We're trying to recapture their capacity to access whatever degree of relative motion that they do have.
Versus taking
somebody and saying, oh, well, I'm going to use 108.8 as a guide. Because first of all, it's a flat angle. We don't want to do that. Secondly, you can't make somebody into something that they're not. And so that's kind of what we're talking about. The idea behind the constrained representation of the infrastructure, so it doesn't move. So it loses its capabilities to move through a full excursion of ER and IR, which means that you've also got compensatory breathing strategies in play, which means you also have superficial musculature in play, which means that there are specific behaviors that will be limited and associated with that musculature behavior. So that's what we're talking about. We're saying, oh, we have this behavior that would be associated with this type of a person based on their structure. And then that leads us and it provides us with guidance regarding their tendencies for movement. And then we can say, well, if it's restricted, then this was what guides me how to reverse engineer the process to restore their capabilities.
Yeah. Okay.
Based on their structures.
A lot of things we just went through there, but yeah. For everyone that's listening to this podcast, that's in and out, like so many of us are, as we listen to podcasts, Bill is not saying that 108.8 is something to chase. Quite the opposite of that. So tune back in real quick. I'm going to try to summarize what we're talking about.
All the people that just wrote that down really quickly.
Yeah, they're like, 108.8.
Just erase it. Don't worry about it.
Yeah, they're in their car on the way to work, and they're going to go chase 108.8 degrees now with all their patients and clients.
Yes.
But yeah, so what we're talking about is, I think it's important to realize that a lot of times whenever if you're getting a problem case, or you're getting a post-op, you're getting a post-injury athlete, you're having someone that is this issue or that issue, when you look at how they breathe, the infrasternal angle and the rib cage is probably not going to be dynamic. So in the beginning, we kind of talked about the compensations that will change that behavior to where it's not moving. So that's an important thing to understand first. If you're measuring an infrasternal angle that doesn't move when they breathe, that isn't indicative of their structure yet. When you have a dynamic infrasternal angle and you're putting your hands on it to measure it, that is going to show you the behaviors and tendencies of that person's structure. So I think that needs to be something that people, you know, rewind that and listen to it, because that's important, is that they might be stuck in a certain position, but that doesn't make that person wide or narrow if you put your hands on their rib cage and when they breathe, nothing moves.
The narrow bias is that it would be a compensatory exhalation, which means it's going to IR the infrasternal angle, which means that it does not ER and open. Okay.
Right.
This would be the open position. This is the universal symbol for opening, which would open towards your face, kind of a thing. And then the wide would be out here, and they would have difficulty closing it.
When I'm looking at a normal narrow ISA behavior, they are going to have the ability to
bias would be exhalation bias, which would close the ISA. It's going to bring the ISA towards its exhaled representation more so, because they have to use a compensatory.
Right. So they're better at X. They're going to be biased more towards exhalation, and then the Y is going to be more biased towards inhalation.
Their structural bias as actually that. And then they have to use compensatory strategies to actually overcome that.
Right. And when we're dealing with the wide, we're trying to restore the ability to exhale from that position.
Normal exhalation.
So
it's like you have to understand, like there's a structural bias, there is a breathing bias, and then there is a compensatory strategy. So there is a three-layered perspective here.
Okay. Like, so this is where we go into the three-layer perspective for each.
Yes. Yes. Okay. So by structure, a wide ISA would love to just remain in this ER'd expanded state, right? The problem with that is that if you allow that to perpetuate, they can't move. They literally have no space for movement. They exhaust it, right? And so what they actually have to do is they have to use an exhalation based strategy to actually close their volume, to constrain the volume within a certain space. So they actually do have a space in which to move. Then because of that breathing bias, they have to use a compensatory strategy to take a breath in against it, right? And so you have a structural bias, you have a breathing bias, and you have the compensatory strategy. And when they're using the compensatory strategy, that's the thing that perpetuates all of the negative secondary consequences that are associated with the loss of movement. And so then you're narrow, on the other hand, structurally, they are biased towards an exhalation. They have to use a breathing bias towards inhalation to actually expand themselves to create a space to move into. And then they have to use a compensatory exhalation. And then the compensatory exhalation is the thing that perpetuates the compensatory strategies.
Okay.
So, and then, so it's, so, so, and again, this is, this is, I don't know how many people actually understand that sequence of events, because again, you have a structure, you have a breathing bias based on that structure, and then you have a compensatory strategy. And if you don't have the compensatory strategy, right, and you have sufficient tidal volume, you really don't have a problem.
Yeah. So that's kind of what I wanted to get into next, is that we're restoring. So knowing that if you have someone with a narrow structural helical angles, the angles that you're dealing with of the infrasternal angle are still going to remain narrow in bias when they breathe dynamically. It's still going to be narrower. A wider person is still going to be in this sort of wide bandwidth. Uh-huh. A narrower person is going to be in this narrow bandwidth based on structure. What we're trying to do is optimize the tidal volume given that person's structure. This is why we can't use 108.8, because you have a narrow, you're dealing with a narrow open cylinder or a wide open cylinder. So that skews that number. So there isn't one to chase. What you're trying to do is maximize relative movement, and relative motions are going to like live with optimized tidal volume, like the space.
Right. For the individual.
Idiosyncratic.
Right. Because, while they can create as many averages as they want, if you don't see the distribution, so let's say we measure 1,000 people for whatever measurement that we're going to do. And it's like, we could say like, okay, the average measurement is X. And then, but what you don't see is this distribution as to how extreme it can be. When we talk about the wide versus narrow, we're always discussing the extremes as the representation of tendency. And that's an important thing to understand, because the further you get, so somewhere in the 8 billion people in the world, there's the widest of wides and the narrowest of narrows. They are going to demonstrate every principle that we talk about at those extremes. And then people are going to have a tendency to move in one direction or the other. Perhaps somewhere in the world, there is this average human being that married an average woman, had two average kids, lives in an average house, and lives an average life. But we never see him, because he doesn't do anything. He's not good at anything. These structural biases provide tendencies that allow certain people to be amazing tennis players or amazing high jumpers or amazing sprinters, right? These structural biases give people superpowers, or unfortunately, they make them physical therapy patients.
Yeah. They're always dealing with some type of movement issue or pain or soreness or whatever it may be. Okay. So when we're talking, so I'm trying to rewind here. Mm-hmm. You've got someone coming in. First thing that you need to be able to do when you're looking, if you are concerned with the ISA, measuring ISA, using it in your training programs, whatever that means to you, we're going to try to tell you what that should mean. You have this person in front of you. You are watching this movement behavior of their infrasternal angle. First step, does it open and close in the way that we would expect? So you have this sort of circumferential expansion and compression. You're not getting a lateral spreading on the table. You're not getting the whole rib cage to move in one piece up towards the shoulders, correct, which would be two things that we don't want to see. Correct. Instead, you're getting, like Bill was making, that sort of motion with his hands.
Yeah.
You're getting this sort of full circumferential movement. You're getting an ISA that swings open and comes closed.
Yeah.
That is what you're measuring first. If it is stuck and it's not moving, or it is compensatory, you have to figure out why that's happening and address that first. Once you restore that dynamic ISA, that will also, for the most part, coincide with restoring relative motions, which is your starting point for movement. That's your potential energy before you use kinetic energy and move through space.
Yes.
So these are the things that I don't think people are considering. That's why this podcast exists, because we're asking them to reconsider.
Right.
But once we've gotten to that point, then we're able to label someone as, you know, this narrow behavioral tendency, this wide behavioral tendency.
Yeah.
Then we can start introducing our training tools and our intervention techniques for the wide or narrow archetypes. Correct. And we've talked about that in many different episodes and in many different posts on the network.
Yes.
But I think hopefully what we've just talked about over the last like 30 minutes or so helps clear up what infrasternal angle means, how you need to look at it, and then what you would do with it.
Yes. It is merely a representation of the structural constraints that provides an understanding of this person's capabilities and tendencies.
Yeah. Yeah.
I think there's at least two videos on the YouTube and then on the network. Like, if you're going to actually try to identify one versus the other, there's a way to do that.
Right. That was our last episode.
Yes. And then, and then throw in the other elements.
And then there was a training. There was a narrow training episode and there was a wide training episode,
yeah.
I believe.
Yeah. So there's multiple, influences that will help guide you. The thing that you want to, first of all, if you misidentify it, typically, I won't say it would never happen. Nobody dies, but this is where you're running safe to fail experiments. This is the first rule. It's like you're doing safe to fail experiments, and then people will behave based on their tendencies. And so, if you're ever in doubt, you do something, you see what happens, and then that's going to provide you the next step of guidance. So even if you misrepresented it and you were way off, like I said, basically nothing happens that's bad. It's just that you don't get the desired result. And then you go back and you say, well, maybe I misidentified this. And then the way you get good at this stuff is you do it hundreds of times.
Right.
You know, like nobody ever is good at pattern recognition by being told how to recognize a pattern. The way that you learn pattern recognition is you do stuff and you do it over and over and over again. You make a lot of mistakes and then you go back and then you reevaluate and then you do stuff and you make a lot of mistakes and then you go back and you reevaluate. And that's how you learn how to do everything. Right. So nobody's going to be able to tell you exactly how to do this. We provide guidance to do this, but then you actually have to interact. You have to do this to get really, really good at it.
Yeah. So if you're bringing people in, laying them on a table, throwing the goniometer on the infrasternal angle, and then just stamping them wide or narrow.
We can't help.
Don't do that.
We can't help you with that.
Yeah, so that might be what's happening. I'm not saying it is necessarily, but if that is, then remember that if you've got this infrasternal angle, I'm just going to repeat what I've repeated three times already. I don't care. if you have an infrasternal angle that's you're looking at and you're having this person breathe on a table or standing or however you want to look at it, and it's not moving, then you can't label it wide or narrow yet. Figure out what's causing it to not move. Restore the movement of it, then figure out where you're at, then move forward. I think what a lot of people typically do is the former, where they go, this person's wide, throw them into the wide program, didn't work. Oh, well, we put them in the wide box. It's like, that's, you know, make sure you have like a starting point to work from.
And that's all we're actually talking about here. It's the starting point. Yeah. What's our test for all those that have, you know, endured?
I want to know what. So I don't. When you were in college, all you old folks were in college, and you were training. Did you just drink like coffee as pre-workout? Did you take like no dose or caffeine pills or anything? Did they have pre-workout yet? Like, was that a thing where you could buy powder that was specifically for pre-workout?
You could buy diet pills that had caffeine in it.
Oh yeah. You guys had the ephedrine.
The stack. It was aspirin, ephedrine, and something else.
I think it was caffeine too.
Yeah, it might. You might be right. You might be right. Yeah.
Dale will know this. or if Jim Laird is listening to this one, he'll know all about that stuff.
Yes.
So when I was in college, I would. Yeah, when I was in college, we would take what were the big ones? No Explode was a huge one. There was like this big thing about
Caffeine. NO Explode?
Was it? Yeah, NO Explode.
Nitric oxide.
Yeah, all these vasodilators and nitric oxide boosters and caffeine supplements, and then that was a big one. There was one
the stuff called, that had niacin in it.
Yeah,
so you get the big flush.
Right. There was one called Jacked that had a three for the E. That actually got pulled off them. I took that all the time, and I was getting like heart murmurs and stuff. And they pulled that off the market. It actually killed some Marines because they would go on a tour. They don't sleep. Like some of these Humvee drivers would have to just pop pills to stay awake, and their hearts were stopping basically. So I used to take that. But the one that I took a lot of, yeah, it was so terrible that I was taking this up. And I would take this stuff at like 8 p.m. after I was done with work and homework and stuff. And I would go out, me and my buddy, we would go train for like, we'd train from like 7 to like 10 p.m.
Oh, Jesus.
And we would take this, the one that we always took a lot of was called Black Powder. And it came in this black, tub. And it was like blue, it was blue flavored. So it was definitely not up Bill's alley, but.
Blue flavored? Is that what you
said? Well, yeah, you know what the flavor of blue is, right?
No, I don't eat blue food.
It's like blue raspberry. Anyone that knows the blue flavor knows what I'm talking about. You don't eat blue food, so you wouldn't be able to relate. But yeah, so I guess my question for anyone that's still listening after this long diatribe is what were the pre-workout supplements that you were way into?
That's awesome.
Yeah. Black powder.
Black
Jacked.
Powder.
That was the big one, man. I could still taste it.
Oh man, that's a serious